I'd like to begin in Proverbs chapter 10. At the beginning of Proverbs chapter 10, it says these are the Proverbs of Solomon. And tonight, I want to look again at the Proverbs of Solomon, and in particular, two main subjects or two main topics. And they are, firstly, speech, or the use of the tongue. And if you're like me, when you hear that subject mentioned, you cringe, because I'm sure all of us realize that that is one area that we all fall down in. James, in his letter, speaks a lot about it. He makes it very clear, and he says something like, if any man can control his tongue, then he's a better man than I am, or something to that effect. If any man can control the tongue, he says, that is something that's more than most can achieve. So it's a rather sensitive subject. And the second one is social concern, or in more traditional language, love your neighbour as yourself. Just before we look at those proverbs, a few words about the nature of Hebrew poetry, because what we're reading here is poetry. And Hebrew poetry is not like English poetry. In English poetry, we get the style of the poetry through rhythm and through rhyme. Hickory dickory dock, the mouse ran up the clock, if you can call that poetry. But you know the sort of thing that I mean. In Hebrew poetry, we don't have that. The rhythm of Hebrew poetry comes through a balancing of ideas, which means that Hebrew poetry can be translated into any language and still remain poetry. You can't translate English poetry into another language and it still remain poetry because the words won't rhyme. But Hebrew poetry doesn't depend upon rhyme. So we can read Proverbs or Psalms or the Prophets or Job or Ecclesiastes, these are the poetical books, and we can still get the real flavour of the Hebrew poetry. This balancing of ideas, I'll just give you a few examples taken from the book of Proverbs. The most common type of poetry is that where you get the same thought expressed twice in different words. And we are not to get bogged down looking for very fine distinctions between the first line and the second line in that type of poetry, because that's just the way the poetry is. Two lines to say one thing, like this. To get wisdom is better than gold. To get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. The same thing, to get wisdom is better than gold, understanding better than silver. That's very common in Proverbs. And the other one that's very common in Proverbs is where two opposite things are said. In that first example, the same thing is said twice. In the other one, opposite things are said, like this. The righteousness of the blameless keeps his way straight, but the wicked falls by his own wickedness. Now that's very common in Proverbs. The good one is this, but the bad one is that. There are a couple of other types. One of them is where you get the central idea expressed in the first line, and then it's supported by an application, like this. The wise of heart is called a man of discernment. Now that's the basic statement. The wise of heart is a man of discernment. And then the application of that in ordinary everyday life, pleasant speech increases his persuasiveness. He's wise of heart, he's got discernment. How does that apply? Pleasant speech increases his persuasiveness. And the fourth category I've got here is similar to that, where you get a basic idea and then a further development of that idea. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. The first one, then developed as you see the outcome of it. Acknowledging God, and then he directs. So that's just by the way, to give you an idea of the different types of Hebrew expression. Alright, we'll look now at this first topic, which is the topic of the use of the tongue. Chapter 10, verse 14, we'll start there. And we'll just skip through and touch on verses here and there. Wise men lay up knowledge, but the babbling of a fool brings ruin near. Ruin to himself. The wise man stores up use or stores up knowledge for use on the right occasion. The babbling character only brings himself trouble. The wise man brings himself benefits. The babbling man brings himself trouble. There's a good point in that verse 14 about wise men laying up knowledge, and I believe it's something we should be constantly doing, and really I suppose it's what we're doing tonight in reading through Proverbs. We're just laying up knowledge, we're just storing it up, hoping it will be useful to us. There are some people who only read the Bible if they think what they're going to read is going to be immediately relevant to them. I want to read something that's practical for me today, that's what they say. And that is a very short-sighted approach. And as a result, you'll find many people read the Bible and are not storing up knowledge. They're reading half a dozen favourite books and go backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards over these favourite passages and remain totally ignorant of huge portions of God's Word. And what happens if you're like that is that you don't have a store of knowledge. It's a sort of hand-to-mouth type of existence. And so you stumble from one crisis to the next. Because all you're interested in is something that's relevant for me today. Well, frankly, I'm interested in more than something that's relevant for me today. And sometimes I read Bible and whole slabs of it, and I don't see anything particularly relevant for me today. But that doesn't matter. I'm not always going to live in today. And if I just keep storing it up, who knows, in a couple of years' time, I might be in a position where that is very relevant to me. Or I might meet someone next week where I can use that acquired knowledge. We are to build up layer upon layer. And the same in our teaching in the church. Again, people will say, we want preachers who will give us something that's relevant to our immediate needs, which sounds impressive, but when you think it through, it's very short-sighted. Because we are simply going from one crisis to the next crisis to the next crisis to meet our immediate needs. I'm not saying we shouldn't meet our immediate needs, but I am saying we should do much more than that. We should be building up, so that we have a fund of God's Word that we can draw on for our own benefit in all sorts of situations. And also, hopefully, help other people. The wise man lays up knowledge. He just doesn't live hand to mouth and get enough to nibble on for today and leave it at that. It's a constant layer upon layer upon layer as we build up and so become competent in the whole of the Scriptures and not just half a dozen favourite books. After all, the Bible does consist of 66 books and it's all God's Word, and we should be wise men and lay up knowledge. We move on to verse 18. There's a little bit there about the tongue. Emphasize the words hatred and slander here. He who conceals hatred has lying lips. He who utters slander is a fool. He's not saying it's wrong to control our temper. Sometimes we can conceal and control our temper. He's not saying that's wrong. What he's saying is that if we conceal hatred, we really hate that person and we're glossing it over. Now that's deceit. He said, if you conceal hatred, then that's like having lying lips. We're not supposed to be like that. That's the person who is something and makes out he's something else. It's one thing to control our feelings. It's another thing to have hatred in our heart and yet try to make out that we are something different. Verse 19, we all know about this one. When words are many, transgression is not lacking. But he who restrains his lips is prudent. Use words sparingly, that's what he's saying. The more you speak, the more you talk, the more mistakes you make. Verse 20, the tongue of the righteous is choice silver, and the mind of the wicked is of little worth. Notice there the connection between the tongue in the first part and the mind in the second part. Because words show the worth of a person's mind. And it shows, of course, the worth of the person himself. And so once again, the tongue and the mind are connected here in the writer's thought. Flip across to chapter 12, verse 14. And here we have a connection between honest speech and honest work. Now in the previous verse we had a connection between thoughts and words. Here we have a connection between actions and words. Verse 14, from the fruit of his words a man is satisfied with good, and the work of a man's hand comes back to him. Honest speech, like honest work, brings satisfaction to the person. The work of a man's hand comes back to him means that you do something worthwhile and it brings satisfaction, and you benefit, your life increases in its quality because of something good that you've done with your hands. Now likewise, he says, your words. Worthwhile speech is a way of enriching your own character, which is in contrast to the babbler that we saw in our first verse. Streams of words going on and on and on and saying nothing, talking all the time but saying nothing. Here he says, the fruit of words brings satisfaction when speech is worthwhile. But it's not always worthwhile, as verse 18 tells us. Here are rash words. Rash words are like sword thrusts. That is, they bring injury. We've all experienced that. We've given it and we've taken it, where the word has gone out rashly and it's been like a sword thrust. And 5 seconds later, we're sorry it was said. But it's too late. The injury has been done. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts. But the tongue of the wise brings healing. A great ministry to be done in healing. Some people are quite proud to say, I told him what I thought. Not always the best thing to do. Now sometimes it may be the best thing to do, because we can sometimes make hypocrites of ourselves through trying to make out that we're something that we're not. But on the other hand, we are not to forget that we must be disciplined. And sometimes it's better to hold back patiently than to shoot our mouth, because they can bring injury instead of healing. And we've got to have a ministry among each other and among the non-Christians of healing. This world is torn apart with injury and with offence through ill-chosen words. The tongue of the wise brings healing. Truthful lips endure forever in verse 19, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. Just think of the wealth of information we have there, the wealth of teaching. I guess every one of these verses could occupy us for a whole night, and I think in my very first talk I said that what we're to do in the book of Proverbs is to take them verse by verse and just meditate upon them. Well, we don't have time to do that right through, but if I can touch here and there, and perhaps we can meditate on some of these things. But you have here the lasting quality of truth. Truthful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue is but for a moment. And the trouble with lying is that it brings only temporary relief. You're in a tight corner, how are you going to get out of it? Well, it's much easier sometimes to speak a lie than to speak the truth, because if you speak the truth it might create complications and you might be given away, and you may have to stand firmly for what is right and honest. But by a simple lie one can sneak out very easily, and so the matter is calmed over for the time being. But as he says, it's only for a moment. That's the trouble with it. It's only for a moment. A lying tongue is only for a moment. Temporary relief, but no lasting benefit. My father used to say to us when we were boys, he said, if you're going to be a good liar, you've got to have a very good memory. And there's a lot of truth in that, isn't there? Because sooner or later, if you've told a lie, well, sooner or later it's not going to quite hang together and it's going to be found out. It's a very temporary benefit that one gains from not coming clean with the truth in the first place. A lying tongue is but for a moment. Look at verse 23. A prudent man conceals his knowledge, but fools proclaim their folly. Enough said. Verse 25. Anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. And once again, a ministry that we can have to each other, a ministry of encouragement and of guidance to those who need it. Go to chapter 15, verse 1. We've all heard this one before. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Just knowing how to respond to people. It's not easy, is it? On the one hand, we've got to be honest. Yet on the other hand, we've got to be considerate, realizing that sometimes hurtful things can only make matters worse. A harsh word stirs up anger, but a soft answer turns away wrath. Blessed are the peacemakers, said Jesus. Not blessed are those who paper over the cracks, but blessed are those who genuinely work for peace. And so the tongue of the wise, in verse 2, dispenses knowledge. But the mouth of fools pours out folly. Once again, the contrast there, which is fairly obvious to us. Verse 12, the scoffer. We met the scoffer last week when we talked about the simple, the fools, and the scoffers. Well, here is the scoffer. We mentioned last week how that the scoffer was the person who knows everything and nobody can teach him anything. He readily criticizes others, but he's not very interested in hearing anything that anybody else says to him. He's the scoffer, the know-all. A scoffer does not like to be reproved, and he will not go to the wise. He doesn't need to go to the wise because he already knows everything. If you know everything already, you don't need to ask anybody. He's the scoffer. And because when you reprove him, you get yourself a bundle of trouble. I trust we're not scoffers. Or hot-tempered, like verse 18. A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention. Here's the man that flies off the handle very quickly, in verse 18. And he creates an awful lot of difficulty around the place at times. To be slow to anger is a characteristic of God. God, it says, slow to anger, and of great forbearance, of great patience. And that's what we are to be like as his children. We've got to work on these things. It's not much sense just reading them. And I can talk all night on these things, and it's not really going to make much difference to anybody. All we need to do is to remind ourselves here of these responsibilities we have. And as I understand human nature, there's no easy way to success. We're not going to wake up one morning and suddenly find ourselves that we've been zapped during the night somehow, and now we have a great load of self-control we never had before. There's no shortcut. The only way is a constant pulling ourselves up, or saying thank you when somebody else pulls us up, so that we can work on these things and develop the amount of self-control and discipline that's necessary. And certainly it's necessary in this matter of the tongue more than just about anywhere else. Go to chapter 16, verse 21, and you'll see the verse that I quoted at the beginning when I was giving examples of different types of poetry. And here you can find that wisdom produces a discerning eye, and that in turn leads to helpful talk. The wise of heart is called a man of discernment, and pleasant speech increases persuasiveness. Now, when he says pleasant speech increases persuasiveness, he's not talking about the hypocrite. You know, the smooth talker that comes along with all his soft spiel, and the con man. He's not talking about a con man here. But he's talking about a person who speaks genuinely from a heart of discernment. The second part of the verse flows from the first part. You're a wise man, and so you have discernment. And because you have discernment, you know how to speak properly. That is, you know how to use words in a way that are going to increase persuasiveness. Not that you're going to develop into a con man, but rather that through wisdom, one is going to become wise in his speech, and so his speech means something. Wisdom is a fountain of life to him who has it, but folly is the chastisement of fools. The mind of the wise makes his speech judicious. Now there it is again, the mind producing right speech. The Bible has an awful lot to say about the mind. Be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Paul prays, be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and discernment. And we haven't worked enough on our minds, I'm afraid. We're very active people, and we get out and we do things, but I don't think we've worked enough on training our minds to think straight, to think wholesomely, and to develop our minds. And here the man says that the mind of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. And so pleasant words are like honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. It's going to benefit other people. And the person that's always nagging and criticizing and bitter and backbiting and shooting his lip, they're the people that create tension and strife. Here he says, if you've applied wisdom correctly, changed your mind and used it to produce proper speech, then it will benefit not only yourself, but others also. Chapter 17, verse 27. Again, restraint. He who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. In other words, think before you speak. And that is a step towards wisdom. Verse 28 is a good one. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is deemed intelligent. We've all been in that sort of situation, I trust, where we're sitting in on some sort of discussion and frankly we don't know too much about it. Well, the wise course is to sit there and look intelligent even if you say nothing. Open your mouth and you give yourself away completely. So here he says that that's the fool. And I guess we've made fools of ourselves at times when we didn't quite know what to say, but we thought we had to say something, and so we said something stupid and then have made a fool of ourselves. Well, a little bit of advice from a wise man here. Keep quiet, and who knows, they might even think you're clever. But open your mouth, and you're a goner. Verse 2, chapter 18, verse 2, here's another good one. A fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. He doesn't want to know anything, he just wants to talk. He's got a closed mind, but he's got an open mouth. And that's the trouble, you see. Closed mind, open mouth. Be better to keep mouth closed and open the mind first. And then one might have something sensible to say. But here he says he's not interested in learning, he's only interested in giving his opinion. There's a great benefit sometimes in being a good listener. And I have observed, as I've been involved in various counselling circumstances with people who've had problems and hang-ups, but half the time all they want is somebody who'll listen. Because we think we've got to put them straight. We've got to give them our loads of words. And quite often what they want is somebody who'll listen and who'll understand. And so we've got to be swift to hear and slow to speak in situations like that. Understand before we speak. Chapter 26, verse 4. Getting towards the end of this lot. Just a few more here in chapter 26, and then we'll move on to our second topic. Oh yes, chapter 26, verse 4 and verse 5. Very famous verses because one contradicts the other. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. I think we know the sort of situation. It's a little bit like casting your pearls before swine. Some people, it's simply not worth trying to argue with them because you'll just become as bad as they are. Have you ever been in the situation where people have got petty and they've done petty things and made petty accusations, and the temptation is then to defend yourself? And the more you do that, the worse the situation grows. It's probably better just to develop a thick skin and not say anything. Because if you answer some of these fools according to their folly, you might get as bad as they are. And so you start to counter their pettiness and you become as petty as they were. So I think that's the sort of situation he's talking about. On the other hand, in verse 5, sometimes it is better to answer a fool according to his folly, just in case he thinks he's too smart. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. A good example of that is in Corinthians, where Paul, in 2 Corinthians, really gets stuck into the church in Corinth, because there were some pretty foolish people there, and they were making accusations against him, and he throws these back at them to try to get his point across. He's pretty sharp in some of the things he says, because some people are so thick around the conscience that you've got to say sharp things to penetrate. And so Paul does that, and he says, oh yes, I know that we apostles, we're nothing, you're wise, of course, yeah, but we're fools, we haven't done anything, but you've done everything, you're kings, oh yes, you're great, we'd love to reign with you actually so that we could reach up to your great heights, but of course we're only apostles at present, so we can't quite make it. And he talks like this because that was the only way he could get through to them. And so there's a case of answering a fool according to his folly. In fact, later on in 2 Corinthians, he says, I've been talking rather foolishly, but you forced me to it, because it's the only way I could talk to you. You've acted like fools, and I've acted like a fool in responding like this. But there it is. So there you have two different situations. I've often said that for every verse... Oh, no, that's an overstatement. There are many times in the Bible where you'll find one verse that says one thing, and if you look hard enough, you'll find another verse that seems to say the opposite. Well, don't lose any sleep over it. The people who wrote the Bible weren't stupid. What they're saying is that one person needs to be told one thing and another person needs to be told another thing. And wisdom will tell us how to act in different situations. You'll get some verses in the Bible that tell us we've got to work harder. You'll get other verses in the Bible that tell us we've got to relax more. The lazy man has to be told to work harder, and the person that's a workaholic has to be told to ease up. It all depends who you're speaking to. What you say depends on the people you're addressing. And the writers of the Bible were addressing all sorts of different people in different situations. And we have to be discerning and look at the situation. A chap that had been borrowing money from me quite a bit once, I knocked him back after several requests, and I said to him that it was getting a bad habit. And he quoted a verse to me, "Give to him that asks." I said, "Hey, wait a minute." I said, "That's not the verse for you to be quoting to me." I said, "I'll quote one back at you. Owe no man anything." You see, he was using it the wrong way around. The stingy person has to be told, "Give to him that asks." But the person that's always biting somebody else for a loan needs to be told, "Look after yourself and don't get in debt to other people." We've got to be very wise in handling the Word of God and not set one verse up to fight against another. Let's conclude this section by reading verses 17 through to 25, and this really leads me on now to the second section that I want to look at. I've called this section the Neighbourhood Nuisances. If you recognise anybody, well, keep their names to yourself. But I think you one or two names might come to mind, and perhaps we might see ourselves in one or two of these things. The first one is the busybody, verse 17. "He who meddles in a quarrel, not his own, is like one who takes a passing dog by the ears." You get more than you bargain for. The second neighbourhood nuisance in verses 18 and 19 is the double talker. "Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows and death is the man who deceives his neighbour and then says, 'But I was only joking.' After he's got caught, he makes excuses. When he sees the damage he's done, he said, 'Well, I wasn't really being serious, I was only joking.'" These double talkers, they create more strife in churches and neighbourhoods than just about any other type. And then you've got the gossip in verses 20 and 21. "For lack of wood, the fire goes out. And where there is no whisperer, quarrelling ceases." Keep whispering, keep gossiping, and it will just keep on going. But stop putting the wood on the fire and the fire will go out. Stop gossiping and the matter will die a natural death. And then there's the quarrelsome man in verse 21, the argumentative type. "As charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a quarrelsome man for kindling strife." Just like putting more wood on the fire, he makes matters worse. Verse 23. This is an interesting one. In the King James Version, it says something about silver dross on the outside of something. This was one of those verses where the translators of the King James Version didn't know how to translate it. And they were very honest men and they admitted it, because their knowledge of Hebrew was not terribly well developed. And in later years they found out what the words meant. And what it means is something like this: "Like the glaze covering an earthen vessel are smooth lips with an evil heart." Very descriptive, isn't it? An earthen vessel with glaze over the top of it. And so you've got an evil heart, but with smooth talk over the top. That's the smooth talker. So you've got the busybody, the double talker, the gossip, the argumentative type, the smooth talker, and all of these are people who create trouble in the community, be it a community of God's people or any other community. Now if we can go back to chapter 11 verse 9, we'll pick up the other matter that I want to speak briefly about, and that is our social responsibility. "With his mouth, the godless man would destroy his neighbour, but by knowledge, the righteous are delivered. He is a man who is selfish, no concern for the common good, and by his words he destroys other people. Verse 10, we have here a reference to the natural tendency within people to wish that fair play will prevail. Doesn't always happen, of course, but generally speaking, there is within the hearts of most people a sense of fair play. And so in verse 10, when it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices, and when the wicked perish, there are shouts of gladness. He got his comeuppance, serves him right. By the blessing of the upright, a city is exalted, but it is overthrown by the mouth of the wicked. He who belittles his neighbour lacks sense, but a man of understanding remains silent. It has well been said that the most misleading way to feel wise is to feel superior. The most misleading way to feel wise is to feel superior. Feel superior by belittling other people. He who belittles another person lacks sense. But the man of understanding keeps his tongue between his teeth. And as for the talebearer in verse 13, he reveals secrets. And so he creates further trouble in the community, whereas the trustworthy person keeps the thing hidden. Verse 26 is a reference to those who capitalize on the weakness of other people. We see this very much in Thailand, and of course in our more sophisticated society here, it takes on a different characteristic. And that is how people exploit others. One of the great problems in Thailand is people who hoard rice, hoping to push the price up. And the power is in the hands of only a few people, but the population as a whole suffers at times because these people hold back the rice, forcing the price up, and then getting much gain for themselves, but at the same time driving 60 or 70% of the people into hunger. The people curse him who holds back grain, who hoard food in time of need, but a blessing is on the head of him who sells it. The man who will sell it to help the poor, even if he doesn't get a lot of profit, that man will be blessed. And you can update that in our society and to see what the application might be for us. Chapter 14, verse 28 tells us that no man is an island. We cannot get on without other people. We like to think we're independent, but we aren't. And we cannot exist without others. And those of us who are at times tempted to go off and do our own thing must remember that no man is an island. Even a king cannot exist without his people. Verse 28, in a multitude of people is the glory of a king. Not in being king all by himself, but in the multitude of his people is the glory of a king. And without people, then the king is ruined. Not much use being a king if there's nobody to be king over. Be king all by yourself, that's not much of a kingship, is it? So he said even the king needs people in order to be a king. If there weren't people, he wouldn't be a king. He wouldn't be a king of anything. Which is another way of saying none of us lives for himself. We've not to deceive ourselves that we can get on and do our own thing and everybody else is unnecessary. Chapter 17, verse 17 gives us another one. These are some of our responsibilities in society, in our neighbourhood, in our district, in our church. Wherever people are living together, we are learning things here about our relationships with each other. Verse 17 of chapter 17, a friend loves at all times. And I know that we've all proved that, haven't we? When there is a crisis in the family, when there is a need, then you really find out who your friends are. And he loves at all times, not only in the good times, but at all times. And a brother is born for adversity. When the going's tough, that's when the true brother stands out. Chapter 19, verse 17. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord, and the Lord will repay him for his deed. God has a special place in his heart for the poor. And in giving to the poor, he is saying, in fact, you are giving to the Lord. And that's one way we can distribute our tithes and our offerings, by helping those who are in need. One of the great tragedies, of course, is that we live in a society where the government does so much that we tend to neglect our responsibilities. Now, I'm not blaming the government for that. I think it's good that we have a state where the government provides welfare for people. Because when you live in other countries and you find the government does nothing, and the poor have no help, and widows have no help, and unemployed have no help, and all these people who find themselves in financial difficulty, they get no help from the governments whatever. So we're very thankful that we do at least live in a type of country where the government does something for people. But one of the problems is that it's rubbed off on Christians in the wrong way. And it's made us, I think, unaware of needs, and we think the government's going to fix it up all the time. And there are poor people, probably in our fellowship, people in need, in our streets, in all sorts of ways. And we have to learn a bit more, I think, of what it means to help those who have financial needs. Remember Jesus, the story of the sheep and the goats? And he said, "You have visited me when I was in prison, and you clothed me when I was naked, and you fed me when I was hungry." And they said, "When did we do that?" And he said, "In that you did it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." As you helped your fellow man, you were in fact, it's as if you were doing it for me. He who is kind to the poor lends to the Lord. And so there's a New Testament application of that. The alternative, of course, is in verse 21, verse 13. And this is the opposite. "He who closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself cry out and not be heard. You didn't visit me in prison. You didn't feed me when I was hungry. You didn't clothe me when I was naked," said our Lord. And I said, "When didn't we do it?" And Jesus said, "In that you didn't do it to these, well then you didn't do it to me. He who closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself cry out and not be heard." And that parable finishes with them crying out and being cast into outer darkness. Chapter 22, verse 16, another verse which has to do with oppressing the poor. And here we have this horrible greed, which is just about the most characteristic feature of our society. "He who oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth, or he who gives to the rich, will only come to want." In the first half of the verse, you have the person who oppresses the poor to increase his own wealth. That's the person whose sole concern is profit. The person who is greedy for gain. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with profit, but there's everything wrong with making profit the sole consideration. And when we operate any aspect of our lives where the sole consideration is economic gain, then we are acting as those who are not Christ's. And particularly if we make ourselves rich by ripping off others who can't help themselves. Because economic power gives us the muscle to do more or less what we want to do, and the people who are most vulnerable are, of course, those who can't defend themselves. And so the wealthier a person gets, the more he can achieve what he wants, and the less the other people are able to defend themselves. "He who oppresses the poor to increase his wealth is going to suffer, and likewise he who gives to the rich," in other words, bribing the people in power, bribing those with influence in society, giving to the rich so that you can get your own way. And there's a lot of that goes on in our society, and I think you know that as well as I do. Well, these are some of the warnings that are given to us here. Chapter 25, verse 16. This is our last section, and we'll read just a few verses here. "Once again, a warning against greed, because ultimately greed will destroy. If you have found honey, eat only enough for you, lest you be sated with it and vomit it." Little parable, the love of money is the root of all evil. The hardest thing in the world to control. If you have found honey, just take enough for yourself. Don't be led on and on, otherwise you'll lead yourself to ruin. Some helpful advice in verse 17 concerning our neighbours. You've read this one before. "Let your foot be seldom in your neighbour's house, lest he become weary of you and hate you." Perhaps our writer had a few neighbours around the place that he could well do without at times. Self-control once again. Knowing when to stop. Verse 18. A man who bears false witness against his neighbour is like a war club or a sword or a sharp arrow, making false accusations. Horrible. Verse 19, trust in a faithless man in time of trouble is like a bad tooth or a foot that slips or a foot that's out of joint. A person who lets a friend down, just like an aching tooth, you can't trust him and he just gets on your nerves. And verse 20 is the person who is flippant at the wrong time. You know the person, you've got a group of mourners and then somebody cracks a joke and it's like a lead balloon. Something that's totally out of place, flippant, but doesn't really know how to behave himself at a certain time. Verse 20, he who sings songs to a heavy heart, that is he who cracks jokes or is unfittingly full of mirth and flippancy, he who sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day, or is like vinegar on a wound. He's got some very good illustrations, this man, hasn't he? Well, finally, verses 21 and 22, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat, and if he is thirsty, give him water to drink, for you will heap coals of fire on his head, and the Lord will reward you. In other words, if you are wronged, don't react in bitterness, but rather treat the wrongdoer as a friend. Give him something to eat if he's hungry, give him something to drink if he's thirsty, and in so doing, verse 22, you will heap coals of fire on his head. And what's that mean? Well, various people have suggested what it means, and I don't profess to have the last word on it, but it appears to me that the meaning is something like this, that in so doing, you will give him some sort of burning sense of shame for the way he's treated you. That in doing good to him who has done evil to you, perhaps you might make him realize his mistake and so cause him to feel a burning sense of shame, which hopefully will turn him to the right way. Well, so much for the book of Proverbs, so much for the wisdom of Solomon. But before we go, let us remind ourselves of the wisdom of the greater than Solomon. Listen to the words of the one who was greater than Solomon. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbour and hate your enemy. That's not in the Bible, incidentally. That was said by some of the Jewish leaders, but they didn't get it out of the Bible. That was their own corruption. The Bible never says hate your enemy. Even the Old Testament says love your enemy. But they had twisted that. You have heard people say, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. But I say, says Jesus, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Question. When did I last pray for someone who's persecuted me? For some brother that said something evil about me? When did I last pray for him? Not praying in the sense that he'll see his wrong, but praying in the sense that I want to desire his good. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. If you love those who love you, if you only love those who love you, your own set, brother so-and-so and sister so-and-so, only those of your own little group, what credit is that? Even the tax gatherers do that. The dregs of society, the lowest people in society, even they do that, he says. You, he says, must love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, and then you'll be sons of your Father who is in heaven. You must be perfect, as your heavenly Father is perfect.